Now we'll go to a presentation of the Chinas. The old altogether four of them. The oldest of them is the Republic of China, Chunghwa Minghwa. It was established in 1912, and its first president was Sun Yat-sen. He had some 30 or 40 names in his life. Sun Yat-sen is the one that he used in dealings with Western countries. Sun Wen is the name that he used when he signed documents while he was president. And Sun Chungshan is the name that is normally known in Taiwan. The main party of this republic was Kuomintang. In 1949, the party retreated to the island of Taiwan after having lost the internal war in China. At that time, Sun was no more alive. Chiang Kai-shek, which is the Cantonese reading of his name, or Jiang Jieshi, which is the Mandarin reading of his name, was the president. And he stayed as president for 30 years in Taiwan until he died. Then the next president was his son, Chiang Ching-kuo. Here we had quite usual dynastic change from the father to the son. But the son then established fairly working democracy in Taiwan. During his 10 years of tenure, and the following presidents were democratically elected. Taiwan is this island here, but there are also other parts of Taiwan that were quite near the mainland. This group of small islands called Matsu and so-called Kinmen, which is very near the mainland. During the decades of practical warfare between Taiwan and mainland China, especially Kinmen was a place where mainland Chinese army used to shell at some occasions, even daily. So being in service there as a Taiwanese soldier was fairly dangerous. But nowadays, complete peace is between these two entities. People live in Kinmen and go daily to work to the mainland and then come back in the evening. So movement is simple and peaceful and easy nowadays. And there's no more any special warfare between these countries. Also, they are two separate countries. In practice, although not in name necessarily, well, it's a complicated thing. But lots of cooperation and movement between these two places. Taiwan is not very big. It's 23 million people. And it is composed of various ethnicities. Some of them are so-called original Taiwanese, who are not so very many. Then there are two types of Chinese who have moved to Taiwan in different historical periods. There are those who came in Chiang Kai-shek in 1949. And they are Chinese. They can be called Chunghuaren. Also those Taiwanese who earlier, during the previous centuries, moved to Taiwan can also be called Chunghuaren. It means central and exalted people. The Chinese people call themselves with a very nice name. Taiwanese people, this is a denomination for those who came before 1949. And they sometimes call those who came afterwards Shinaren. China is a Japanese name for China, and it is, there's nothing exalted in it, so it is not a bad name either. But they maintain difference between these two groups. The difference between the earlier Chinese who came to Taiwan and became Taiwanese people and the later ones, who can also call themselves Taiwanese if they want, and many sometimes want. But this difference can be seen also in the parties that are nowadays there in this country. And there's a number of parties, but two of them are main ones. One is Kuomintang, the old, original Republican Party. Its agenda is that China is one country. During the old Cold War period, the idea was that the Republic of China in Taiwan, may be one day able to conquer the mainland China and unify the country in this way. That, of course, never happened. The size of these two entities is so different. But Kuomintang is still thinking, at least arguing, in terms of one China. But the unification should take place far in the future, not anywhere near. The other one is Democratic Progressive Party. The division between these parties does not go simply along the ethnicity lines, but the members of this party are more those people who are Taiwanese people. Its agenda is more about that of independent Taiwan as a separate republic, but it does not argue it very strongly. Both parties are basically in the center because Taiwanese people don't want anything drastic to happen, especially in respect to mainland China. So this idea is very far in the future. The first directly elected president, Lee Teng-hui, he was a Taiwanese person, but he belonged to the Kuomintang Party and stayed in power for fairly long, 12 years altogether. And he actually, although he came from Kuomintang, was fairly independent-minded and actually helped the Democratic Progressive Party to be established. Next president, who is still now sitting, Chen Shui-bian, he was from Democratic Progressive Party. He was in power for 8 years, fairly long also. The first president who was not from Kuomintang, and thus far the only one only. Ma Ying-jeou, who is now the sitting president and re-elected again this year for a new 4-year period. His agenda was Butang, Budu, Buwu, no reunification, but no independence either, and no war. Very close, amicable, good relations with the mainland China. And that is the kind of line that worked well with the Taiwanese electorate. So no specific change came after this. These were the 5th direct presidential elections last January, almost a year ago. The challenger was Tsai Ing-wen. And she's a female. She would have been the first female president in Taiwan, but she lost. Her agenda was not practically so very different from that of Ma Ying-jeou. But the Professor Joseph Cheng from Hong Kong City University has a specific lecture on this aspect about Taiwanese domestic politics, Taiwanese society, and Taiwan's relation with China. So I leave that aspect to him. Then we have the People's Republic of China, the biggest country in the world. The establishment of the Republic was proclaimed by Mao Zedong 1st October 1949 at Tiananmen Square. There's a memorial photo of this event. If you go to Tiananmen Square, Mao is still there. He's there whether we have summer or winter, he's always there. And always, every day, good weather, bad weather, Chinese people, also tourists, come to see him. So he's still, in a way, taking care of the country and looking at what people are doing there. He is not in the same position that as Kim Il-sung in North Korea, who is still the eternal president there, but Mao is still very important in China. If you think of the generations of Chinese leaders, we have now had quite many. None of them have been really democratically elected. They are chosen within discussions of the Chinese Communist Party. But Mao Zedong was the first one. Very long-time leader, and nobody really was able to challenge him as long as he was alive. The second generation leaders, Hua Guofeng and Deng Xiaoping, they were a bit younger than Mao Zedong, but both of them had been part of the independence, of the internal war in China. Deng Xiaoping especially was very strong also, but he never held any high position either in Chinese state or in Communist Party. He simply was the chairman of the Central Military Commission, and that was enough to make him the supreme leader, as long as he was alive. Again, telling that the Chinese leadership structure at this time was quite special. It was based on individual human beings and their personalities. Hua was in power only for 2 years. His personality did not fit the leadership of the country. So he was deposed. Jiang Zemin was helped to power by Deng, and he was in power a decade. He was a Soviet-educated engineer, so technocrat, but did okay in his job. And he had two prime ministers, Li Peng and Chu Rongji, and both of them were also engineers. Li Peng in Soviet Union, and Chu Rongji in China. Then we come to the presidents that are still, or the leaders that are still sitting in their positions, Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao. Again, we had engineers, both of them Chinese educated, so they did not have no more any long direct foreign experience, but we are able to conduct Chinese policy, especially domestic policy, quite well. But China has never been thus far very skillful in diplomacy. I don't say that it is the reason why that the leaders were engineers, but that is an aspect that China could develop in the future. During this autumn, the Communist Party of China again had a great convention, and new leaders were chosen. Xi Jinping, who will quite probably next March become the new president, he's not only an engineer, but he's also a social scientist, well concentrated especially on Marxist theory and propaganda, but anyway, he has also done social scientific studies. And Li Keqiang, which will likely next spring become the new future premier, he is a lawyer and an economist. So we are moving towards more social sciences, whether we can see it in Chinese foreign policy or not, will be seen in the future. They are expected to stay in power for 10 years because this has been established thus far as a normal period for the current leaders. We don't know who will be the sixth generation people. They could again be foreign educated because China has been sending to the past near decades tens of thousands of students abroad, and many of them have been able to rise into quite good positions within the Chinese Communist Party, Chinese economy, Chinese administration after that. Then we have third China, Hong Kong Special Administrative Region. It used to be a British Crown colony since 1842, and in 1997 it reverted back under Chinese sovereignty. It is still a capitalist place. It used to be perhaps the most capitalistic entity in the whole world, also during the British period, complete free trade, free enterprise. You could, if it was legal, you could do any kind of business there. One country, two systems, one a socialist system, one an extreme capitalist system. And still we have only one China. So the conception of China is now quite wide. It can contain many kinds of systems. When Hong Kong became part of mainland China, or People's Republic of China, it was promised for 50 years its current system, British established system, will stay the same. We don't know what will take place in 2047, when the 50 years have passed, because also China itself will be quite different at that time. This year, there are 7 million people in Hong Kong, living in quite small place. It is the most tightly packed metropole in the whole world. It is part of this one China, but yet it is different. If you, for instance, want to travel to Hong Kong and you do it via Beijing, you would think that you take a domestic flight to Hong Kong, but no, you take a flight abroad. And if you are a Chinese person, you need a visa to Hong Kong, but if you happen to be a Finn, you don't need a visa. So even though it is within this conception of one China, in practice it is a foreign country. It's also one of the richest places on earth. It is full of banks because it's an extremely big financial center. There are hundreds of banks from all over the world in China, in Hong Kong. And it lives by this kind of, well, on these monetary flows and also arranging Chinese foreign trade and foreign investment. There are companies that don't want to invest straight to China, but they can do it via Hong Kong. And also there is mainland Chinese money who want to appear as foreign money. So they can come to Hong Kong and deal with one of the hundreds of banks there and come back to China as foreign direct investment. So Hong Kong is important and very well-to-do place because of that. The fourth China is Macau. It was established in 1557 as the Portuguese trading post. It is the first and oldest European possession in China. In the beginning, it was not a colony. It simply was a place where Portuguese were allowed to trade and live by the Chinese administration. Only in 1887 it became a Portuguese colony, when at the time when China was very weak. Regia Administrativa Especial de Macau, da República Popular da China. It is also, like Hong Kong, a special administrative region. And the same policy, un país, dos sistemas. One country, but two systems. Much smaller even than Hong Kong itself, only 500,000 people. And it's also rich. Very well to do. Like in Hong Kong, there are also many banks in Macau. And tourism is a very big business there. And it is one of the biggest gambling centers in the whole world. Both foreigners, but especially Chinese people, go there to gamble and spend their money. What should we think of these systems where you can have many kinds of political systems in one country? And in practice, two of them, even three of them, Macau, Hong Kong, and Taiwan also, because Taiwanese economy is so tightly connected to the Chinese economy nowadays. They are separate countries. They have been set up with an old classical conception of imperial, classic imperial space, where we have a center, which is in Beijing or mainland China. But in the outskirts of the center, you can have separate units which still belong, but which do not need to obey the center's rules as strongly as in a nation state you should do. And the characteristic of classical imperial places is that if you have two centers, like the socialist world and capitalist world, like in this graph, small units, and they are always small, small units in the middle can actually have characteristics of both of them, or even more strongly about one of them, and still show allegiance to the other one. The simpleness, freedom of movement in between this kind of imperial spaces. And to some extent, perhaps also, at least out of Mongolia, can be seen in this kind of place. It's still strongly influenced by Russia because of its Soviet Union history. It was independent also in the Soviet period, but very tightly controlled by the Soviet Union. Nowadays, Chinese capital, Chinese workers are moving strongly to Mongolia, Most of its imports, like food items and so on, come from China. All construction workers are from China and so on. And as Chinese have much more capital than the Russians, it's slowly moving towards the Chinese orbit. Tibet, the Muslims in China and Inner Mongolia are clearly within the state boundaries of mainland China, but some extent of ethnic specialty has been allowed for them, depending on the place. If we have independence movements, then the Chinese state tends to crack on them. If they are peaceful and loyal to the center, then they can be more independent in their own environments. And this is also part of this classical imperial system of organizing space. There will be also another lecture by Luo Tianhong, professor at the Renmin University, describing the intellectual climate of China and its relationship, especially to Europe, but also to USA and Japan. And this is the end of this introduction to this Chinese.